Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Kaya Mitra, Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Carolina at Asheville. Her new book, Philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, is just out from Bloomsbury Academic. The Bhagavad Gita is one of the foundational texts of Hinduism and probably the one most familiar and popular in the West. The moral problem that motivates the text, is it right to kill members of one's extended family if they are on the other side in a war, leads to an extended discussion of such themes as rebirth and reincarnation, and the personal paths to unity with the universe through the yogas of action, knowledge, and devotion. Mitra's new translation is aimed at those who are interested in themes that cross-fertilize with Western philosophical debates regarding the nature of morality, the relation between body and self or mind, the roots of character, and the goal of a well-lived life. The translation aims at a middle ground of accessibility with recognition of the multiple and context-dependent meanings of Sanskrit terms. And the philosophical themes are elaborated with the aid of questions that are appropriate for both Western and non-Western approaches. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Kaya Mitra. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Carrie. I'm very happy to be here.
And I'm looking forward to our discussion about your new book, The Philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, which is it's a new translation, annotated in a way that is sort of aimed at bridging the gap for Western philosophers mainly about knowing what sort of philosophical themes there are in the Gita. Before we get it into the text itself, maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your interest in philosophy and your background and how you came to write the book.
Sure. So I grew up in India, you know, in the Bihar and Bengal, that eastern part of India. And the school I went to, the secondary school, that is until the 10th grade, we had logic as one of the courses that one could take. And I took logic, basic syllogistic Aristotelian logic. Liked it quite a bit. And then when I continued and did my what we would call higher secondary, which is 11th and 12th grade, we had philosophy as an option, philosophy as a subject one could take. And so I took 2 years of philosophy. We studied, basically mainly Western history of philosophy and some ethics and more logic. So anyway, when I was in college, my parents wanted me to go to a particular college in the area where we lived. And the college had what we call philosophy honors. You know, it's sort of like the British system, which would be something like what you call a majoring in this country. So, yeah, and I was, very happy to be take honors in philosophy. But the interesting part was also that I had done quite well in that higher secondary exam. So I could have, I think sometimes I joke that my being a woman helped me in that regard, because if I were a son, a typical Indian family, I think there would be pressure for me to go into a professional, program, or at least try to get into a professional program. But here I was a woman, and, it didn't really, have that much of a thing about having to earn a living. Anyway, so that's how I got into philosophy, and I stayed in with philosophy. So
good. And then you also went to graduate school there, and And in the States?
That's right. So I, you know, that was undergraduate philosophy. Then I got a master's and MPhil and a PhD in philosophy of language in India. And then, I came to America to get another PhD. It does sound I guess it's not completely not done, especially you see so this is 94 when I came to America. There were not that many postdocs, you know, even today there aren't that many postdocs in philosophy. And, you know, they were rather, you know, I didn't really try for them because it was very hard to get come by, you know, one of the postdocs. So I just, wrote GRE and TOEFL and all that and applied and came for another PhD program. It's also, you know, PhD's application process for foreign students. It's quite expensive. So when I was going through the PhD in India, I had a national fellowship from UGC, Indian. It's called University Grant Commission. That's Indian kind of gives out grants. So I had a really nice grant from them, and I was able to save money and everything to apply for American programs. So that's how, I came to the U.S. and did another PhD at University of Connecticut.
Okay. The Bhagavad Gita, I mean, it's one of the texts, or if not the text, that is, you know, the most familiar of the texts, foundational texts, I suppose, of Hinduism. Uh-huh. Could you just, you know, for those who aren't all that familiar with it, could you describe what the book is and where it, you know, it's kind of, you know, the context in which it's written?
So yes, Bhagavad Gita, or, you know, as it's often referred to as the Gita, it's a part of one of the Indian epics, or you could call it the Sanskrit epics of Mahabharata. And it's in that story, it's situated in that storyline of Mahabharata, which is basically a war between two sides of a royal family. And what Gita has is it's a very kind of a dramatic opening, right? You know, it's the two sides are all ready to battle in the battlefield, and Arjuna, who is a warrior on one side, goes in there and says, you know, but these are, remember, people who are related to each other, right? Because these are part of the, you know, two sides of the same extended family. So Arjuna sees, you know, his uncles and everybody else, his teachers on the other side, and he says, no, I'm not going to fight. You know, he just has what you call loss of heart, you know. And his charioteer, who is Krishna, and comes out in the course of the Gita that he's also supposedly an incarnate of the Hindu god of Vishnu. Arjuna basically, so this is the first chapter. The first chapter is just, you know, Arjuna's basic dilemma, you know. And then the rest of the Gita, which is, you know, 17 more chapters. So Gita altogether is 18 chapters. The rest of the Gita then is Krishna telling Arjuna why he should fight. And at the end, of course, Arjuna says, yes, I'm resolved now. All my dilemma and questions are gone. I'm start fighting. But in that process, right, it's 700 verses, you see. So it's not a very short thing. It's altogether, it's 700 verses. And in that, Krishna touches upon many different things, philosophically, quite interesting and important themes to make this argument, this long argument to Arjuna why he should fight. Yeah, so.
Okay, good. I want to get into those themes. Uh-huh. But I suppose one question that would that comes to mind is just what are you trying to do in the translation? I mean, there's the translation, and then there's the bringing out of these philosophical themes. So I just want to focus for a moment on the translation itself. I mean, is there you're trying to strike some sort of a middle ground in terms of translation? Was there a need for a translation? What did you want to accomplish by doing this new translation?
Yes, and that's a very, very, very fair and good question, because not only there are lots of translations of the Gita available in English along with other languages, but I mean, as we speak, new translations come out every year, two to three at least. So I think for me, it was a very important question, why another translation? Going through graduate school, I would have never imagined that I would translate the Gita. Now, I had studied Sanskrit in college as an undergraduate, so I did have the Sanskrit skills, but it's especially, while leaving graduate school, especially when I was having to teach the Gita in the American classroom, and the translation we would use, and I still like the translation quite a bit. It's Barbara Stoller Miller. That's a translation that she did. I think it came out 1986. That was very helpful, very accessible. But I have to say that there were, what she had called standardizing, normalizing, So there were some of the nuances, and actually not just nuances, I think rather philosophically important and relevant factors were lost in that process of normalization. So I, wanted to have a translation that had that, But now there are lots of other translations, that are available in English, even for the academic audience, that are, I would say, get it, but maybe try to tell the full story of the Gita. So almost every nuance is important. And especially, I was teaching in an undergraduate classroom, that was, I wanted something in the middle, that would have good accessibility, but enough context that gives us the flavor, of the Gita and how it came and the language. And so maybe if I can give you one example that, in the Gita, and actually it is, you can see this in other sort of epic text as well in other languages, but Krishna, and Arjuna, they refer to each other, not just very rarely, actually, as just simple Arjuna or simple Krishna. They use a lot of these epithets, And what Miller did was she said, well, I'm not going to use those epithets because for Western audience, they have no meaning. And I disagreed with that because Gita, it's a very relational, even the ontology, it's a very relational worldview that the Gita, I take the Gita to be proposing. And I think the calling Arjuna by a son of Kunti or Krishna by, you know, these kind of different names are actually important in that particular context to give us that that relational, situational, you know, nature of their being. So so that's why I kind of thought that, no, it's important, maybe I should try to do a translation. And just to add quickly, initially I thought I would just do an introduction and a translation. And it's actually, I'm very thankful to Simon Brodbeck, whom I had shared my translation early on. And he said, yeah, you know, I think there are some important good points your translation is bringing out, but I don't see enough of the philosophy, right? Why? Because I had from the very beginning, I wanted the philosophy to come out and for a Western audience, you know, for especially in my classrooms. So it was really when Simon Brodbeck pointed that out, I thought, that's right. So that encouraged me to come up with this idea of what every chapter, after every chapter translation, I have something called Philosopher's Corner, where I draw out the philosophical themes that I think of important. But also, yeah, as you mentioned, Carrie, that for... Western comparative context, but also cross-cultural comparative context, you know, where you have comparative possibilities with Buddhism, with the Taoist ideas, so Confucian ideas. So it's that's what I have tried to do in my translation and in this book.
So maybe we can jump into some of these philosophical themes. I mean, there's a number of concepts that are just going to naturally come up, I think, in the discussion. So rather than discuss these concepts sort of up front, maybe we can discuss them as we go through some of the themes. And I'm thinking of, you know, karma, you discussed that, and various ways of understanding the concept of yoga and so on. And there's more details. So maybe, okay, so the first chapter, as you note, you know, it's Arjuna going through this dilemma. He doesn't want to fight his relatives because it seems to be wrong, right? To be killing, you know, people who are in your family, extended family. And so the rest of the Gita, as you mentioned, is an extended argument that convinces Arjuna to fight, right? And that begins in the second chapter with a discussion of the idea of acting without attachment or action without attachment. So maybe you can go into this philosophical theme first, since it seems to be it's critical to his argument.
Yeah, I think that, it has been argued, and I agree with it, that the second chapter, by the way, it's the second chapter and the 18th chapter. Those are the two longest chapters in terms of how many verses they have. So, both are kind of, in a way, second chapter opens, contains almost all the arguments that Krishna is going to bring in summary. And then chapter 18, of course, as it summarizes a lot of the ideas that are presented. So that's why the Gita, of course, gets taught in American classroom. That's how is this idea of action without attachment, right? So, the idea is that Krishna says to Arjuna that, look, I understand your sorrow, but you are acting like someone who talks like a wise person, but is not really wise, right? Because what, you know, and so where is Arjuna lacking? So it's a kind of an ontological argument that Krishna is making, who is saying that you are confusing two categories that are not to be confused, right? You are mourning for something that ought not to be mourned. And so he's introducing this dualism or distinction between the body, right, which will come to an end. You know, whether Krishna, you know, whether Arjuna, the body is subject to death. Of course, there is no other way about it. But then there is the self. The self cannot be touched, cannot be, you know, he has this very kind of poetic verses that, you know, it cannot be touched by fire, it cannot be, you know, made wet by water, and so on and so forth. So the self cannot be killed. So why are you so worried? You know, what is the cause of your sorrow, your dilemma? And Krishna says it's because you are attached to your actions, right? And what that means is that the actions are, when we think that we do our actions with certain intended outcome, that's what the attachment means, right? So I want to do X because I want X to, you know, have this outcome. Right. And then when I think that X may not bring the outcome or X doesn't bring the outcome, I get all upset and, you know, that kind of stuff. So where attachment, you know, sometimes we think attachment here does mean that attachment to a conceived or perceived outcome. Right. And what Krishna thinks is that if we fall to that that dualism between mind and the self, sorry, not mind and the self, but the body and the self, and then we think that we take the body to be the self or something, and then we act for certain intended outcome, and when those outcomes don't come around, and that's what Krishna's, right, Arjuna's worry is that, oh, I will kill my relatives. And what Krishna is saying, that first of all, you know, as will come out, you really don't kill them, who they really are, and the bodies are subject to destruction. Now, I'm by no means suggesting that this is not problematic, right? But that's why these are, I think, philosophically very pertinent, you know, for a discussion in classroom. So that's sort of the idea of action without attachment. So do what you have to do, what your location and, you know, what you need to do, but not for the whole idea of developing this yoga of action without attachment is being able to not be, you know, too hung up on a particular outcome. That's what.
Okay, so the idea is that Arjuna won't be killing them because their self will not be dying, just the body would be. And then what is the intended outcome is to just kill the body?
Yes, I think, you know, and I struggle with that too. And the second chapter doesn't quite talk about the intended outcome. But in the course of the Gita, actually, this is an interesting, very interesting text. I find it very politically, you know, what this text is doing for Hinduism within the Mahabharata, but what this text has done in the socio-political context of Hindu identity. you know, in later 19th century, 20th century, during the, you know, the Indian nationalist movement. But the intended outcome, I think, Krishna says, you know, at one point, Krishna has a verse where he says, these have already been killed by me. You know, so in a way, you know, be my instrument. So what is the intended outcome here? I think the answer, the answer that Gita might offer to that is that, you see, these all actors, you know, they have their own earned karma, and they will have their death wherever that would fall, right? Because, you know, bodies will face death. Bodies will have come to an end. And so the, you know, Arjuna is just being a kind of an instrument to that process. You know, Arjuna ought not to, now this is what Krishna is trying to argue for, that Arjuna should do. Arjuna finds himself in that battlefield, correct? You know, in as the one of the major warriors. And of course, there is that whole moral nature of the story. Arjuna is on the side of good, according to the story, and then the Kaurava side, his opponents, you know, have done lots of bad things. And so it's also a way that a kind of a normative, you know, story is being told. But coming back to your question, what is the intended outcome? Well, the intended outcome could also be the let's everybody's karmas play out, you know? Yeah.
Well, you brought up there are a couple of different themes there that you mentioned. One is this idea of you know, acting without regard to an intended outcome, and that does have a sort of it has a kind of a Kantian flavor, at least in the Kantian aesthetics, when he talks about the concept of disinterest, right? So, I mean, I'm not going to go into that, but. I was just wondering, there are a number of Kantian themes that you brought out in relation to this argument about action, you know, without attachment, and the impartiality, and the disinterest. Could you say something about that theme? And then you also mentioned karma, of course, which is its own sort of concept, and there's a lot to be said about that. So first, you know, the sort of the Kantian theme, and then second, this you know, how you understand the concept of karma as you've translated it, and then, what role that plays.
Gita's, I think even very early on, philosophers' interest in the Gita really was for its how much it sounded like Kant's, you know, the deontology principle, that the idea of duty for duty's sake, you know, that do what you have to do without having any, the sort of non-consequentialist idea that why we should do an action is because it's our duty or it's the right thing to do. And a lot of philosophers think even today, those who do comparative philosophy, those who do want to engage with the Gita, think that Gita gives a very, very easy, you know, very almost ready-made parallel with the Kantian idea, you know, especially in Kantian ethics. And of course, one could argue that in Kantian aesthetics as well. So yes, I actually have argued, and I try to argue in this book as well, that yes, that is true, that, you know, Gita does talk about the action without, worrying about the outcome, but it's actually, I think, if we take the fuller picture of where Gita is saying this, the, and also the context of Kant, you know, the egalitarian sort of individualist context of Kant, there are more differences than there are similarities. But yes, you are right that that argument, that you know, that comparison is has been made quite often. Let me just say one difference that I see. I think that you see. For Kant, agency remains, you know, very important for Kantian, you know, ethics of action, right? You know, autonomy. And very interestingly, in the Gita, actually, autonomy is, I mean, even the whole idea, you know, when Krishna says, be my instrument, right, to Arjuna, it's not, you know, do what, you know, the autonomous, that idea of autonomy actually is far underplayed. And I might even argue that at the end of the day, it's not even important at all in the way that it is important in Kantian ethics. So, that, but you see, once again, you see why I think that I want us in the Western context to engage with the text, because I think it allows us to draw out all these nuances, right? So that was the answer to the or response to the comparison with Kant. Now, in relation to karma, you know, it's a fraught concept, especially as you know, in my book, I actually keep many of the Sanskrit terms not translated. Like I leave yoga, I leave dharma, you know, the Sanskrit transliterated in, and then I provide a glossary. Now, with karma, I did translate it, you know, and part of the reason is because karma, you know, has such in popular, you know, culture, people use that term in so many ways, and I was worried to sometimes get. I think in the Gita and many other Indian contexts, and here I mean not just Hindu, but also Buddhist and Jain religious philosophical context, karma is used as a technical term, I would argue. And it, you see, it kind of captures that idea of it's like the natural principle that regulates our everyday lives and our actually experience and our world. Now, karma works with the idea of rebirth, right? That this, you know, these South Asian context, religious context, you have this idea that people, when things die, and not just human beings, almost any animate things, when they die, they come back, or some part of them, or some, you know, causal consequence of them, something comes back, you know, it gets reborn over and over until, of course, it is able to get out of this cycle, right? And what karma does then is karma is sort of the repository where all the intended actions that you have done, right? All voluntary action has a kind of a residue that gets deposited in the karma account with the individual, and then that kind of determines. And Gita really, in a way, crystallizes that idea that how you come back, and that's where, you know, in the caste system comes in Hindu context. And in chapter 18, Gita, you know, kind of says very clearly that, in a way, you know, what you have done in your life, which is, you know, what you've done, will color what your karma constitution looks like, right? And that will determine where you will be born. So whether you will be born as a child of a Brahmin or Kshatriya. So that's how the karma works. So karma is like an operating principle, right? In a way, it's sort of in the background. And I have, and others have also called it a law. The reason it's a law like it operates sort of naturally. It's a part of the natural moral fabric of the world in this system. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there a conservation principle?
Yeah. So I mean by conservation principle, you mean?
I mean, like, there's only so much, you know, good and bad in the world, and it gets, you know, distributed all around. But, you know, kind of like energy conservation. I don't know. That just occurred
that's
to me.
I mean, so the Gita, you see, the interesting thing is that, you see, I love this because I think the Gita allows us, you know, and we may not find a specific answer to that question in the Gita, but I think Gita can be a place where we get into these kind of interesting cross-cultural, you know, comparative discussion. So I think in a way what there is that, you know, karma kind of keeps this thing going. But the goal, of course, is for individuals to get out of this incessant sort of cycle of birth, you know, life and death and rebirth. And that is when you have nothing left in your karma. Right. And that's when you have done, you know, that's what those three yogas that the Krishna proposes, yoga of action, yoga of devotion, or yoga of knowledge. Right. All of these three are ways in which you will come to act not for an intended outcome, but just because that's the duty. That's the thing that has to be done at that moment, right? That will allow you, because once you do that, then you are not producing any karma residue, right? Because you are not acting for a particular outcome, right? You're just acting because that's the duty or that's what has to happen. So then once you don't have any karma, then you don't get to be reborn, because it's the karma, it's the force of the karma, right? That remnant that, you know, hurls you back, as it were, into another existence. And for a world to end, everybody's karma has to come to zero, correct? It's a possibility. But you see, in that very nature of our action, there is a kind of a conservation. Do you see?
Yeah, but there's an interesting, I mean, in you know, popular culture, you know, the idea of karma is more like a good action, right, a positive, you know, and so the implication is you want to do things that produce good karma, you don't want to do things that produce bad karma, but in actual fact, that you don't want
exactly,
to produce karma
that's
at all.
Exactly right. And I think that's something that I've seen my students, you know, struggle with. Wait a minute, karma is good. And I say, yes, karma is good in the sense of, yes, getting you a better rebirth. Right? You might get to be reborn as, you know, I don't know. Sometimes I think being born as a, in this context, you know, part of the Brahmin caste. But the ultimate goal of life, you know, in the Gita, Krishna says, becoming one with Krishna. And that doesn't happen until, you know, your karma, you know, you are completely devoted, you know, in this way, that bhakti, you become a bhakt, you know, a devoted to Krishna, so much so that the karmas they disappear. They are not there because you're not acting that way. So karma really, you see, the way we understand it, you know, good karma, bad karma, both are a mechanism to kind of keep the moral order of the world going, right? But the goal of human life, and definitely the goal that Krishna is proposing in the Gita, is that get to a place where you don't nishkama karma. You act without that attachment to outcome.
Okay, which you know brings up is sort of a stoic theme, right? I mean, let me just ask about you mentioned the three different yogas, and many of the chapters actually go through what are these different yogas, how one is supposed to do them and which ones are appropriate, I guess, for different people, or which, and the one that he likes most is the yoga of devotion. What is the concept of yoga here? And then can you say something about how that interacts with, I guess one of the things that you raise is, first tell us about the different yogas and why he likes the devotion one best.
Yeah. So, yoga is one important concept in the Gita, I think yoga could arguably be that. And in fact, every chapter, right, these 18 chapters are titled Yoga of, Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, so on and so forth. So everyone is titled as a yoga. And yoga is, you see, I didn't translate it. And actually, I'm not alone. There are some recent translations that are leaving yoga. Barbara Stoller-Miller translates it as discipline. And that's okay. But you see, yoga here, at least, has a whole variety, whole sort of number of meanings, but at least it means both the process, in my opinion, as well as the goal, right? So yoga of action, now the word yoga in Sanskrit, it comes from the Sanskrit root. It could mean to union or to unite. And so yoga then means that which allows, the self which is in the body, which is definitely is argued as a part of Krishna, or part meaning here more like not a physical part, but a representational part, kind of, right? One sort of the idea, the principle of Brahman or principle of reality that is there in Krishna is also in us, right? And that's the self in us. But then we also have these bodies, and the yoga then is the way that the self becomes one with Krishna, right? So the yoga means that ultimate union, going back to Krishna. But yoga also then, in the way that it's used in the Gita, that it also refers to different processes, right? Different various ways. And while it's true that Gita, it's the karma yoga, which we talked about, the yoga of action without attachment, jnana yoga, right? Yoga of knowledge, which is sort of the yoga that is, prominent in some other Hindu text as well, like Upanishads. It's sort of, because remember at the beginning I said that even in chapter 2, Krishna says, your whole sorrow is caused by a sort of a primary confusion between two things that are utterly different, right? Between the self and the body. So the jnana yoga or yoga of knowledge it talks about, you know, knowing, right, gaining insight into this dualism or dichotomy or difference. And then the last yoga is the yoga of devotion. And a lot of, you know, Gita scholars have argued that this is a yoga that becomes very prominent in the Gita, partly because you see karma yoga is hard to do. You know, Jnana Yoga, yoga of knowledge is also very hard. And Arjuna says that in so many words. These are really hard things to do. And Krishna says, yes, they are. But then don't worry about those. There is that, yeah, there is the yoga of devotion, which is all you have to do is act, you know, I think one way of looking at the yoga of devotion is surrender your agency. Right? Act as if you are acting for me. Okay? Whatever you have to do, whatever comes up, act not because you want this result or that result, but as a. So that's how one becomes a pure devotee. And you see that yoga is important, and it becomes very, because almost one could argue, now this is also, you know, could be rather controversial, but one could say you don't need to, you know, develop all these very difficult processes, you know, develop this controlling your mind, which is what you need for the yoga of action, or controlling your intellect that you need for yoga of knowledge, and so on and so forth. All you need to do is complete surrender in Krishna. So, you know, that is a Gita, that is a yoga that is often argued that it's available to everybody, right? Of course, Krishna does mention a few other yogas as well in the Gita, you know, so yoga of buddhi, which is sort of the intellectual, right? You are, but all of them are aiming for the same goal, which is all the union with the Krishna. So yoga is used in these two senses.
Okay. Good. That was very helpful. Well, there's you know dualism here. I mean, that's a big theme. Obviously, I mean, it's sort of the theme in a way. Is the resolution of dilemma rests, you know, essentially on this idea that you know, there's the body, and then there is the self. What in the, and that has an obvious correspondence to philosophies in the West of dualism, you know, most famously, obviously, Descartes with the mind-body dualism. What do you see? I mean, you discuss this, you know, as you translate and discuss, and you know, a number of the different chapters. So it's I can't specify a particular chapter because the theme runs through the Gita, but. What do you see as the differences between the dualism as presented in the Gita and then the Western views of dualism that many listeners may be familiar with?
Yeah, this is one other reason why engagement with the Gita and actually other Indian Hindu philosophies would be it's very interesting, because unlike the mind-body dualism, interestingly, in the context of the Gita, the mind also is a part of the sort of physical perishable reality. You see, that's why I have said self-body dualism, right? And the self is what is that. And it's interestingly, you know, self is sometimes viewed with a consciousness in Indian context. And some of the interpreters of Gita have said, you know, self has pure consciousness. But I have some other article where I have argued that actually, it is not the case. I mean, pure consciousness is not viewed as the given, property of the self or in the Gita. So what I'm suggesting is the way that Cartesian way of looking at the dualism, right? The mind-body dualism and my body of by extension, and then mind characterized by consciousness. And then, of course, you have the psychophysical causality problem, right? If these are two very different things, then how do they interact? How is it that when I want a cold drink, I walk to the refrigerator, right? In the case of the Gita, and there are a lot other Indian Hindu context, philosophical context as well, that problem actually doesn't arise because both mind and the body are in that, the what they would call prakriti, or sometimes translated as nature, which is where change happens, which is where, causality happens. And then you have the self. It's not an unproblematic dualism. Dualism in itself brings certain, philosophical questions that have to be answered. So I'm by no means suggesting that self-body or self-prakriti dualism is not problematic or anything, but it does avoid some of the problems that we have been plagued with in the Western context of mind-body dualism. So it's an interesting, another version of dualism that we can consider.
I'm trying, that was one of the things that I was trying to get my head around, was this idea that it's both part of what you call the prakriti, which was translated, I think, as more or less as sort of matter or change. And they're both, body and self are both aspects of that. And I kind of wondered, well, would this really count as a dualism in the Western sense at all? Or more of a, it sounds more like a monism to me, or what we would call a monism, which is just that, there is mind, in our terms, there's, the mind and there's body, but they're both, kind of aspects or emanating from the same substance, which is neither body nor mind, sort of a Russellian monism.
Yes, I think you are actually right. Because this, the self and the prakriti, right, the body and change, Krishna identifies as his higher nature and his lower nature. So really, I mean, there are some philosophical, Hindu philosophical schools like Shankhya, where these two, or even in Naya, these two are viewed as a dualism, right? These two are two irreconcilable principle or irreducible principles. But in the Gita, you are right. The even though, in many places, the way to look at it is in this dualistic way that, there is Atman and there is the body, right? In the chapter 2, when he's talking about, one is subject to death and one is not. And why? And the one that is not is really you. So why are you so worried, right? So there is that dualistic line being pushed, but you are right, Kerry. At the end of the day, in the Gita, everything is subsumed under Krishna, because Krishna clearly says, this is Purusha, or which is where the self is housed. The Purusha is my higher nature, and then Prakriti is my lower nature, and this is how the world is created. So you are right. At the end of the day, It is a kind of a monism. I don't know whether it's a, so I need to think more. That's a very interesting idea, Russellian monism. The only worry I might have is that it's, you know, it is a very personalized monism, right? Krishna remains, you see. And so another way, you know, why Gita is so popular in Hinduism, I think because Gita allows that, you know, human or personal interaction with a divinity. That you have, so yes, it is monism, but which is in, you know, Krishna remains as this person that you can be, that you can devote yourself to, right? That you can give up all your action to, you can plead with, you can talk to, right? So, that's what I would say.
Okay, I'm not sure. Let's see, we're running out of time, and there's a lot of different themes to that still remain that you touch on. You know, one of them, another is the idea of the three gunas, right? What you call guna, goodness, passion, and then dark inertia, and then how we all have all three of these, and they somehow explain different human characters by, I guess, the proportions that each one has of each. Could you maybe quickly, because I don't want to keep you too long. Could you explain this? And then, you know, again, there seems to be a relationship there, at least between some ways, or in Plato at least, right, where he divides people into, you know, gold and silver and bronze, and there seems to be a very common theme there between dividing people up into different classes according, you know, allegedly according to different natures. So could you say a bit about that?
Yeah, so the three gunas is, you know, sort of often refers to as that, like the three ropes that builds prakriti. And remember, prakriti is from which everything, every changeable things in this world, things that we can touch and interact with and all of that phenomenal world comes out of. And the three gunas, interestingly, you know, the three gunas are, even though they are the source of physical universe, but they are also, remember, the source of psychological universe, because they, you know, mind comes from that as well. So the gunas, interestingly, are satta, rajas, and tamas, or I've translated them, you know, goodness and dark inertia, passion. Thank you. Yes, passion and dark inertia, and that they are kind of the three ingredients. And the you see, even the words that are used to depict them are words that dispositional. They have dispositional nature to them. So then. And, you know, the whole karma theory determines which is predominant in you, you know, the what karma you are putting in. So that's where the good karma, bad karma would come in, you know, will determine kind of. Now, these are all hypothetical. Krishna isn't doing any kind of, you know, laying this out. But I think this is what's going on. So basically, your different karma residue will determine what you have more of, which would determine what you would be, what kind of dispositional qualities you have more, right? So goodness, then you, the qualities that go with it is you will be, you know, you can do complex things, you can study, you can meditate, you know, passion is you can, you know, you throw yourself in action, you know, fiery energy, and dark inertia is basically you more like slothful, you know, very not finishing anything one starts, not able to sort of self-motivate, that kind of thing. And the idea is that your karma determines what you are have more of these three. Now, these three are there in all of us, in everything, but in different ratios. And that you see how then makes sense that, of course, if you have more of satta, then you will be born as a Brahmin, right? Child of a Brahmin father. Because, well, because Brahmin needs to do all that, you know, what the kind of actions that would be dispositionally natural for somebody who have a lot of satta, you see? So that's how it's kind of almost a social structural system, right? How the society gets structured, gets in, you know, hierarchically, and karma and the gunas, the three gunas, play a role in them, kind of in a naturalized explanation of them, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we are running out of time. So I just wanted to ask what is our usual final question, which is what's next for you? Are you doing other translations? Are you turning to different philosophical projects entirely?
Yeah. I'm not doing any other translations because there are other reasons. But the two immediate projects I'm working on is I have a paper on the consciousness, idea of consciousness and attention in the Gita. I believe that, you know, if we can tease it out, it would be really interesting, comparatively speaking, in the contemporary discussion in Western philosophy on nature of consciousness and attention. So I have that paper that I have to revise. And then I'm also co-editing a volume on feminist philosophy of mind. And I have a chapter in that volume on theory of content, feminist theory of content. So I'm working on that and getting the volume together. So those are my two immediate projects. And then I have a longer project on epistemology of mindfulness, where I am using some of the Pali Buddhist texts. So, yeah.
Very good. Well, that's, this is all good in terms of, introducing and spreading interest in more comparative perspectives.
Yeah.
So I wish you luck, and I look forward to reading your future work.
Well, thank you, Kerry. I really enjoyed, and thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, and so goodbye for now.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to my interview with Kaya Mitra, professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina in Asheville. We've been talking about her new book, Philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, which is just out from Bloomsbury Academic. This is New Books in Philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. I hope you enjoy the podcast, and thank you for listening.